Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Morning. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Jeff Huang, a repeat visitor from last week. Jeff has written 4 books on Pot Limit Omaha, in addition to designing new games. We'll be talking to Jeff in a few minutes. This is our first show for Vegas AllNet Radio. We're doing it on a Tuesday morning rather than a Thursday evening.
Yeah, it sounds odd to hear you say good morning instead of good evening.
I thought that was a subtle change. I didn't know if anybody would notice that, but good. Thank you. We're doing it on a as a side, I actually prefer good morning. I use good morning as a all-purpose greeting. Somebody calls me at 6 o'clock tonight, and I'll answer the phone with good morning. So it is so much easier for me to say good morning, welcome to Gambling with an Edge. Before, when it said good evening, it was just so much against my style. But now I'm in my comfort zone.
I feel better already.
Oh, good. Now, we're still in the same suite of offices, but in a different studio. And from our mind, it doesn't feel a whole lot different. Hopefully you'll find the same is true for you. We've been following the legal case of Paul Foy and others. These Malaysian gamblers are accused of taking large bet from the villas at Caesar's Palace here in Las Vegas during the World Cup soccer matches. The FBI suspected they were doing this, so they had Caesar's cut off internet access to the villas. Posing as internet repairmen, FBI agents came in with hidden body cameras and used the film to get search warrants. Last week, a district judge in Las Vegas says using this ruse violated the defendant's Fourth Amendment rights, and at least part of the evidence gathered was thrown out. Over the next 2 shows after today, we're going to be having lawyers on. I, Nelson Rose, will be here next week, and Bob Loeb the week after that. You can be bet we'll be talking to both of them about this case. Do you have anything to add before that, Richard?
No, I'm just happy that they threw it out. It seemed absurd to me, but that was once in a while they get it right.
All right. Now, we've been following the Jeopardy adventures of former poker player Alex Jacobs. He had a great run, $150,000 or so. He lost last night, but he's still likely to be in the Tournament of Champions later in the year. I thought he did well. I thought the Twitter comments on that people posted were kind of enjoyable to read. So it really bothered some people that he jumped around and around. It really bothered some people he didn't have a bigger personality.
I call those people hall monitors.
Monitors?
And there are a lot of dealers that are like that, you can tell they were hall monitors when they were a kid. Don't run in the hall, and you have to follow all the rules. And there are certain dealers that just I find really annoying because they nitpick about all these rules that really have nothing to do with them, but they've taken it upon themselves to enforce these things. They'll see people walking by and ask to check their ID. The guy's not even playing at their table and they want to check their ID just because they got a little bit of power. And
well, when they grow up, they can work for homeowners association. They would fit right in.
Exactly.
All right. So we had an email from someone who read an article about Percy DeConis, who's a magician and a professional mathematician. DeConis is trying to figure out just how shuffled cards get with schmooshing, which is having all the cards face down on the table and mixing them around and around.
Yeah, now the term is washing. I don't know where he came up with this word smushing. But
it's got a lot of letters in common.
Yeah.
Okay, so washing the carts. Now, Richard, you used to be an amateur magician. What do you know about washing?
Well, I the only thing I know is you like any other shuffle, if you're talented, you can overcome it. You can make it look like you're shuffling the cards when you're really not, the same way a magician can do that with a riffle shuffle or an overhand shuffle. But that's not what Percy is trying to accomplish. He's trying to decide how much washing do you need to come close to random.
Assuming you're trying to wash efficiently.
Yeah, and for the casino environment, it's really an inefficient method of trying to randomize the cards, because it does take a lot of time. You know, I think it's insane these casinos pay thousands of dollars to have a shuffling machine on the table, yet they insist on shuffling it before they put it in the machine all the time. It's just such a waste of money and time and effort.
Or they really fear the listeners to this show. They think that extra form of washing protects them a little bit more.
Yeah, but it would be much faster and equally efficient if they just hung garlic around the neck of the dealers, right? It would accomplish the same thing and wouldn't waste time.
Well, I don't know. There are, now you know more about this than I do, but certainly there are players who can beat continuous shuffling machines.
Oh, we can't talk about that on the air.
But when you wash them first, the number of players who can do that successfully goes down. And garlic is not going to affect that. It might affect the number of people at your table. But, all right. Richard's giving me a look saying, let's talk about something else. Okay. Our guest today is Jeff Huang. It's been almost 5 days since Jeff was last on the show. Jeff has written several books on various forms of Omaha poker, and in addition is designing new table games. Jeff Huang, welcome back to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you.
Now, before we actually get to the Jeff interview, there's an interesting man versus machine poker tournament taking place beginning later this week. A professor named Tomas Sandholm from Carnegie Mellon University, which is in Pittsburgh, has created a heads-up Texas Hold'em program called Claudico, which uses artificial intelligence to determine the best possible strategy. The press release does not say whether it's limit hold'em or no limit hold'em. The latter would be a far more impressive achievement. Anyway.
Well, we don't know if it'll be impressive until we see how the machine does against live players.
Now, anyway, the program will compete against four top poker players for 8 hours a day for a two-week period at the Rivers Casino, which is also in Pittsburgh. The word top is in parentheses or in quotation marks. The poker players chosen to compete, Doug Polk, Dong Kim, Bjorn Lee, Jason Less, may be excellent players, but they're certainly not household names. Jeff Huang, how do you think this is going to turn out?
Who knows? From what I know, the players in question are good. There are a lot of good poker players that people just don't know about. But from what I know, these players that have been chosen are high stakes players, and they're legitimate winners. And we'll see what happens when they play a computer.
Here's my prediction. My prediction is that that if they're playing limit hold'em, the computer will win, and if they're playing no limit, the computer will get crushed. That's my prediction. So,
all right,
I think it might be no limit.
You think it might be no limit?
I mean, I read an article where the guy in question who had made this program was creating a no limit hold'em program. So I think it's a good chance it might be no limit hold'em.
And I would think it's not going to get crushed. They're not going to get crushed.
That'll make it much more interesting. So I wonder if this will be live streamed on the internet or something.
It is. It is live streamed. But it's like 8 hours a day for 2 weeks. So there's a lot to watch. And
Actually, that's right. It's going to be on Poker Night in America as well.
Maybe.
I originally saw this article. It went up on Nolan Dalla's blog, and was almost immediately taken back down. And there's something on his blog that says this was removed until we can add further details or something like that. But as I recall now, he did say it was going to be carried on Poker Night in America.
Okay, well, I mean, No Limit Hold'em players use a table presence as part of their information. They, however fast the other player plays or various tells, I mean, the tells at the highest limit are relatively small, but they're still there. And the speed of decisions and stuff is still there. Now, when you're playing against a computer, those things go away. That's
well,
a significant...
when you're playing online, all those things go away other than the speed of how quickly somebody, you know, makes their decision, right? You don't pick up any tells when you're playing online, which
correct.
A lot of the highest stakes players do. So... You know, and I would think a lot of them would randomize the amount of time they take in making their decisions as well.
Well, one of the things that's happening in No Limit Hold'em today is that a lot of the play is based on game theory. So they have game theory optimal strategies. And so the question is probably whether this computer has a game theory optimal strategy for playing this game. If not, it's exploitable. And so they'll be able to exploit the computer's strategy, theoretically.
If they know the game theory, the optimal game theory, better than the machine does. But
the machine is not playing game theory optimal strategy, it's exploitable by definition.
Well, yeah, but I don't think the players are physically capable of playing game theory optimal. They can, you know. So the question is, who can approach it, who can get closer to optimal, right?
I mean, so the idea is that the computer, if it's not playing optimally, it's making mistakes. So... I mean, I don't really know Hold'em that well, but that's the idea, and we'll see what happens when they play this computer, and it'll answer all of our questions.
Yeah, right.
All right, so Richard, you think so assuming it's No Limit, you think the players are going to kick ass, and I think it's the other way around. We have the makings of a bet here. Think of appropriate stakes for the end of the show, and we'll do something.
Okay.
I got $10.
$10. Well, which side are you betting on?
Yeah, which side are you on?
If it's No Limit Hold'em, I will bet the players.
All right. Yeah. Well,
I'll flip a coin that is. I will bet that it is No Limit Hold'em, and I will bet the players.
Oh well, good. So I'll cover that $10, and I have a little bit left over, Richard. If you want to.
Sure.
All right. Good. So, personally, I'm new to Omaha. Now, I had not studied Omaha at all until I read Jeff's first book, preparing for the interview last week, and now I've read a little bit of his second book. So I watch YouTube under Omaha to get a feel for how it was in real life. Now, of the Omaha offerings, I picked kind of at random the 2008 World Series of Poker, Pot Limit Omaha, $10,000 bracelet event, more or less at random. And now I had a little bit of knowledge, but the guys in this final table were playing hands, Jeff, that you called trash in your book. Now, some of that can be explained by the fact that the table size kept getting smaller and smaller as the players busted out. But part of it is using your strategy would have made someone the tightest player in this game. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes and no. So there are really three answers to this question.
You've only given us two so far.
The three basic other questions. So basically, short stack and short-handed tournament play, with like 40 blind stacks, is very different from deep stack, full rank play, cash game play. So in a cash game, when you have 150 blinds or 200, 300, 400 blinds deep, you really need hands that are projectable. When you're playing 40 blinds deep, you don't need hands that are projectable. The second part to the question, or answer, is that you haven't gotten through the first advanced PLO book yet.
I've gotten 42 pages.
Yeah. Yeah. So the first 40 pages of that book are on floating, which you need to understand, the rest of the strategy. So what happens is, you'll find that the hands that you can play depend in large part on the skill set that you have and the situations that you're in. So when you're playing shorthanded and you have the positional advantage, you can play a lot more hands than you can play when you're playing full ring and you're out of position. So if you're in a big blind, for example, every fold is a small blind. Small blind opens with a raise. You're guaranteed to have position. You can play almost any four cards, assuming you play competently after the flop. So that's answer number two. And the third part of it is that you're also looking at a video from 2008. My first book came out in 2008. And before my book came out, the standard recommendations at the time were to play four cards that go together. You can play aces. You can play four cards in a row, like Jack, 10, 9, 8. If you're double suited, that's great. But what you figure out when you're trying to play this game is that those recommendations don't get you very far. So my book was actually the first, and still the only, to break down starting hand construction as a qualitative science. And so back in the day, there was a wide range of loose opinions on what you should play. Even today, you'll find a lot of people playing a lot of different hands. The starting hand, the hands that people play have actually tightened up a bit in the last few years.
And part of that's your fault?
Mostly.
So what you're saying is if Bob went back and looked at the 2014 Pot Limit Omaha World Series, he would find the play at the final table much different.
You would find that it looks you have to read the first advanced book first. But and then it would start to look more recognizable.
Okay, good. Now, last time we discussed the first half of your entry-level book, which was called Pot Limit Omaha Poker, The Big Play Strategy. About halfway through the book is a 100-page section on Limit Omaha High-Low. Let's talk about that now. Take about 5 minutes, Jeff, and explain how Limit Omaha High-Low is different from Pot Limit Omaha.
Okay, so I probably don't need 5 minutes for that. Basically, Limit 08, or Limit Omaha High-Low, has a limit betting structure. It's a split pot game, so the high hand wins half the pot. The best low hand wins half the pot, unless there is no low, in which case the high hand wins the whole pot. You can also win the whole pot if you bet and everybody else folds. It's significantly less volatile than PLO, and is probably more hand valuation driven even than PLO. And particularly at small, like really small stakes like 4-8, 5-10, 6-12, it doesn't necessarily require a whole lot of skill, which should get to your next question.
Good. Speaking of my next question, after the last show, we had a snack together, and you indicated that if I played the $4, $8 Limit Omaha High-Low game at the Orleans here in Vegas, and I basically waited until I got ace-deuce and kept betting it as long as a low was possible, that I'd make some money. Now, if I read and understood the 100 pages from your Pot Limit Omaha book, how much could I make and what kind of bankroll would I need?
So, yeah, I mean, at 4-8, you don't need much of you definitely don't need much of a bankroll, a couple grand, two or three grand. And you could beat the 4-8 playing only ace deuce. You might not win a whole lot. It might not be all that enjoyable. But, you know, for having never played the game before, if you only played ace deuce, you only draw to the nuts, you should do okay. But if you read those 100 pages in that book, you should be able to play at least up to about 10, 20, or 15, 30 pretty competently. And you should be a pretty good-sized winner. Part of the problem is a lot of these, you know, 10, 20, 15, 30, 20, 40 games that used to be popular like 10 years ago are mostly dead. The game is largely solved at these stakes, at the low-limit full-ring games. And a lot of these games have been replaced by No Limit Hold'em and Pot Limit Omaha.
The games are largely solved?
At really low stakes. So the full ring, low limit Omaha is basically solved.
And that was your fault again?
No.
What games can be found? And when you say you can be a pretty good winner, I'm asking this because I have a friend who just lost his job. And I said, you know, I think you could just go play High-Low Omaha and you won't need much of a bankroll and you should be able to make what? $10 an hour, $20 an hour?
I mean, if you're playing 4-8, you might be able to make $10 an hour. This is 7 or 8 years ago. I used to play 10, 20, you know, twice a week. We had this great game in St. Louis, a lot of action, and using his X strategy in my book. And if you're a pretty competitive player, you should be able to make $20, $30 an hour. Now, the problem is the game's tightened up a lot in the last 7 years. because a lot of it said it was populated by a lot of older players who aren't necessarily around anymore. And all of the younger players have gone on to play big bet games like PLO and Nolan and Hold'em. So that's a big part of the reason that these games are dying out. Today in Las Vegas, you can find 8-16 at the Orleans. I have not spent a lot of time playing that game, so I couldn't tell you exactly how much you could make. It's probably a lot tighter than the 10-20 games used to be.
But one big blind an hour is a reasonable number?
I would think so.
Yeah.
All right. Watching No Limit Hold'em on TV today, you see a lot of Hollywooding, which basically means taking a long time to pretend to decide about something that's really quite simple. Compared to Hold'em, does Hollywooding occur about the same amount in Omaha, less, more, and how come?
Pretty much not at all. So what you'll find is when you play PLO is that it actually plays a lot more like limit poker. It's very fast up until the really big decisions, like on the river, for example. Because for the most part, there's a fixed bet size. Everybody bets, for the most part, bets the full pot, except on the river or when the board is paired. So you don't have to spend a lot of time thinking about your decision. You know exactly if you're going to play. If you're not going to play, you're going to fold. The other thing that happens in Hold'em is that you only get two cards. So people spend a lot of time trying to make their two cards look like a lot of different hands. You don't have to do that in PLO because you have four cards. So for the most part, PLO plays pretty fast, except for those few key decision points, typically on the river, or if, you know, maybe for a big stack, or like on the flop. If you're making a decision to play for stacks on the flop, you place a big big bet and a raise, and you have a marginal situation. You might spend some time thinking about it, but you're not pretending to think about it.
I think also that Hollywooding is very much a function of whether it's on TV or not, right? I mean, you see a lot less of that in games that are not televised. There are guys, they want TV time, so.
Well, actually, you do actually see it in cash games. People watch TV, and then they think they should be doing this.
Yeah.
Well, if they're watching TV while they're playing, that probably gives them an unfair advantage. So, but isn't part of Hollywooding, if I take 20 seconds for every one of my decisions, then you can't tell if it's an easy decision for me or a hard decision? Isn't that part of it?
I mean, that's Hold'em. So exactly, you have two cards, and you're trying to make it look like a lot of different hands. And you don't have to do that in Omaha.
Well, it can be a lot harder in Omaha to figure out how many outs you have. And
but that's not Hollywooding.
Yeah, you're not acting in that case. You're actually trying to figure out what to do.
And if you're trying to figure out what to do, I can tell that you're trying to figure out what you have.
Uh-huh. All right. So I can learn how to fake it. Now that'll do me well. Now, assume I'm somebody who's very inept at reading body language and facial tics and stuff like that, but decent enough at following a basic strategy as outlined in your book. Can I be a winning player at Omaha High-Low?
Definitely up to about 10-20 or so.
And above that, I'm SOL?
So once you get to about 15-30 or 20-40, the game starts to tighten up and start to become a lot more aggressive. So you actually need a new skill set. You need to learn how to play against the blinds, which is totally different from what happens in small stakes PLO, or small stakes Low Limit, Omaha High-Low, where there's five people in every pot. A lot of these games, there's still five people in every pot, but there are also more situations where everybody folds to you, you're in middle position or in the cutoff, and you have a hand like ace-four, seven-jack with the suited ace. When you're playing against seven people, you can't really play that hand because you don't flop well enough, often enough, to make that profitable. Because when you have a hand like ace-four, seven-jack, you need really a deuce-three to hit the flop, or if a deuce comes on the flop and you're drawing at the second outlow, you shouldn't be drawing at that. So if you're the type to make that mistake, you shouldn't be playing that hand. But it's different when you open with a raise and you get to play heads up against the blinds. In that case, you're in position, and ace, four, seven, jack, you have a two-way hand, it's actually really hard to lose both sides of the pot when you have a two-way hand and your heads up in Omaha, high-low. So, and you control the pot size. And so you can bet the hand through, and so it's really just a totally different game than just low limit Omaha. And so the answer is no, you would not be able to just, you know, play these games, just playing the limited style of play.
All right. Now, you have three separate advanced Pot Limit Omaha books. First one talks a lot about floating, at least in the first 40 pages. Now, what is floating, and how is it different in Pot Limit Omaha than in Texas Hold'em?
So, to float is to call a bet on one street with insufficient hand values, not necessarily with nothing. Most people define it as nothing. That's coming from a Hold'em background. In Omaha, it's insufficient hand values with the intention of taking the pot away with a bet on a later betting round. You might have as little as a pair, a gut shot, an open and a straight draw, or even a bare flush draw, but the basic principle is the same. You're calling not necessarily because you have your hand's worth a call on its own merits, but also because you have some expectation that your opponent will check and fold on the next betting round. So part of the value of your call is based on your actual hand value, and this is what I call draw equity. The other part of your call is based on float equity, or the expectation that your opponent will check and fold. Now, the most common situation that has occurred is in shorthanded pot. So let's say you're on the button, the cutoff opens with a raise, you call, everybody else folds. Your opponent will see bet the flop maybe 70-80% of the time, maybe a lot more depending on who he is. And you call the bet on the flop, and then your opponent checks the turn, and you bet, and he folds. That's a standard situation, happens all the time. Now, if your opponent is the type of player who will bet the turn, follow the second bet on the turn, you will call less often on the flop. If he is a type to check and fold, most of the time on the turn, then you'll call him more often. And if he's the type to do that, then you'll also call him more often pre-flop. And so when most people describe floating, they describe it as a special play, as a special form of bluff. But what it actually happens is it's standard operating procedure, and it's part of the flow of the game when you're playing shorthanded PLO and also Hold'em as well. One of the other differences between PLO and Hold'em is that floating is a lot stronger in PLO because it's a lot like when your opponent's out of position and heads up, every hand a dog to hit the flop part. So when your opponent's betting 100% of the time on the flop, you can't have a hand 100% of the time or even 50% of the time. So and it's a lot easier for you to have him beat if he has one pair or no pair. It's easier for you to have a pair, two pair. Easier to have a draw and improve. And so it's like your hand's always going to be a lot scarier in PLO than it is in Hold'em.
Now, let's say you were in a PLO game with both Richard and me. And the only reason I'm in this game is because I mixed up my medication this morning. Now, you recognized Richard, and you thought he appeared to be pretty knowledgeable. And you figured I was a raw beginner because on the very last hand, the dealer had to remind me that I needed to use exactly two cards from my hand and three from the board to make it. So, which of the two of us would you be more likely to run a float against, and why?
It's an interesting question.
Thank you.
So, what a float requires is that a player, A, must bet the flop or turn, and then B, you must check the next street and fold to a bet. Okay, that's the first thing that requires. So, in a multi-way pot, floating opportunities are special situations. In a shorthanded pot, as we just described, it's standard operating procedure, and usually happens when a player opens with a raise pre-flop and c-bets the flop. So, this requires that you're capable of opening with a raise pre-flop and then c-betting the flop.
C-bet is a continuation.
Continuation.
It's pretty automatic in No Limit, is it? Not so much in Pot Limit?
This is also a hot topic in the first advanced Pot Limit Omaha book.
After the first 40 pages, unfortunately.
Yes. So because coming from No Limit Hold'em, when this is automatic, people think this is a really strong play. You have to c-bet the flop in PLO. But you're also, like I said, every hand's a dog to hit the flop hard, so it affects the frequency of bets on the flop, and also the frequency of getting floated. But it's a separate question. The frequency of getting floated affects the frequency of c-betting the flop, and there's a whole dynamic. But back to the other question. So in order for me to float you, you'd have to raise pre-flop, and you have to bet the flop. But so by default, since you're a lot less likely to do it, Richard's a lot more likely to open with a raised preflop and then see about the flop. By default, I'm far more likely to float Richard than you.
Even though he's a stronger player.
Well, because you're not likely to raise preflop and then see about the flop. Now, that said, I would float you too. And as I was saying before, it's a standard operating procedure in a shorthanded pot, so it's pretty indiscriminate.
But if I did it, you'd lick your chops. Cause... All right, good.
No, if you did it, I think you're more likely to have a hand. You know what I mean? If you're a rank beginner, I think you're less likely to just make a continuation bet with nothing.
That's correct. So most beginners bet when they have something good. They
right.
figure that's
right.
They fold when they got something bad and bet when you got something good. It makes sense.
I think we should go find out.
Yes.
Well, good. As long as we can do 5 cent, 10 cent, I'm in. I'm willing to take on world class players at those stakes. All right, enough Omaha. Let's talk about game design. You have a provisional patent on a game called Super Blackjack. Tell us what you can about that.
All right. So Super Blackjack is simply blackjack, except you can split it into two cards. It's the first two cards only. And you can double down for up to four times your original wager. You can double after split for up to 4x as well, and with unlimited pair resplits. Blackjack pays 2-1. Now, the catch is there is no hitting. If you want to draw a card, you have to pay for it. You have to either split or double. And there's also a second force wager in the form of an ante, which pays when the dealer pays according to a pay table when the dealer busts, and loses when the dealer doesn't bust. Now, the gist of the game is essentially that you're the bet to the max in standard doubling situations, while using the ability to split any two cards in order to create more doubling situations, primarily when the dealer has a deuce through an eight showing, and also to improve stiff hands. If you have a 9 or 10 or ace in your hand, when the dealer has a 9, 10, or ace showing.
So let me just give an example, because that sounds a little confusing. So I have a 9 and a 4. I can't hit it, so my only option is to split. And now I'm...
double down, which you wouldn't,
no
but
way.
You can.
No. Once I split, I receive a card for free on each of those. Right, so the 9, let's say I get a 10, so I have 19, and the 4, let's say
I get a 7, and you're going to bet the max. You're going to bet the if your original wager is $5, you're going to bet $20 on your double down.
So I can, is it up to 4 times or exactly 4?
You can bet one. You can bet up to 4 times. You either bet the minimum or bet the max. You would never never correct to bet 2 or 3x.
Okay, so a 7 and a 4 is an easy one. Let's say it's a 3 and a 4, so I have a total of 7. So I might want to, let's say I doubled for the minimum to get an extra card on my total of 7, although I can still win if the dealer busts with 7, right?
Yeah, so basically, if you have a stiff hand, after you split, you basically got to stay and hope the dealer busts. I mean, the strategy is solved. So you're going to bet the max, any hard 11. And if you know basic strategy in blackjack, you can kind of figure this out. If you have 10 against 9 or less, you should bet the max 4x. You have 10 against 10 or an ace, bet the minimum, draw a card. If you have 9 against 7 or less, you bet the max. And basic strategy in blackjack is double 9 against 3 through 6. Here is bet the max against 7 or less. Min double against an 8, 9, 10, or an ace. So
you've given us 6 rules so far. On your website, highvariancegames.com, there's actually 49 rules.
Well, but basic strategy in blackjack has.
Okay, and some of the rules are compound, such as with 4-4, you split against 2 through 6, you min double against 7 and 8, and you stand against 9 to 10. But there's 49 of these rules. This is more complex than most... carnival games. I don't know.
The casino should like that then, because it means the players are more likely to play badly, so the house edge will go up, right?
Okay.
Also, the way the rules were written is some of those rules are repeated just to make it easier to understand each category of rules. So the game is perfectly solved. If you understand basic strategy, you can in blackjack, you can kind of figure this out. For the player, it has the lowest house advantage per unit wagered if you play perfectly. If you play perfectly at 6 decks, dealer hits off 17, the house advantage is 0.27% per unit wagered, which is 0.1% lower than craps, the pass line in craps at full 3, 4x, 3x, 4x, 5x odds. So this would be the most advantageous game to, for a casual player, not necessarily an advantage player.
Wait a minute. Wait. Aren't you talking about element of risk, not actual? Okay, so if we compare apples to apples, what is the actual house edge just on your initial wager? Because that's usually the way house edge is measured.
So this is what element of risk is. So I call this adjusted house advantage, but it's house advantage per unit wager, and that is apples to apples. House advantage, the standard measure of house advantage is on the base unit. So, you know, in Baccarat, there's only one unit wagered, so the house advantage is the same thing as the element of risk or just the house advantage. In a game,
but in craps, you take odds, but yes. we don't look at the element of risk if you take three, four, five odds.
You do, actually. This is how craps is described. So the pass line in craps is 1.41% on the base unit. If you're looking to gamble, money is no object. So, you know, it's different for... You know, if you're looking not to gamble, you're looking at risk as low as possible. But if you're looking to gamble as much at the lowest edge per unit wagered, and you're betting 3x, 4x, 5x on the odds, but you're betting the full odds, then the house advantage on craps is like 0.37%.
The element of risk. Yeah. Okay, so what is the house edge on your base unit in your game?
So on the base unit, it's 1.06%.
1.06, okay.
Or 0.5%. Yeah, it's a 2-force bet, so it's 0.5% per...
But there's a huge difference on... Although taking odds requires minimal skill and placing money on the pass line takes no skill at all, playing 49 rules accurately takes considerable skill.
And they also have a lower house advantage per unit wager.
But essentially the same. But I mean, slightly lower.
Well, no, it's 30% lower.
Okay.
Wait, so I don't know what the element of risk is for blackjack, right?
So actually, this is on my website as well. So the Wizard of Odds actually calculated for Atlantic City blackjack rules, it was like 0.43% house advantage, basic strategy, and the element of risk is 0.38%, which implies an average wager of 1.13 units per hand.
Okay, and your element of risk is what?
So the average bet is 3.96 units per hand, and the element of risk is 0.27%.
So, okay, 0.27, but there are games here where off the top blackjack that is lower than 0.27.
And that's the other problem with blackjack today is that these casino office doesn't want to offer these games. So what you'll find on the strip, for example, is that you can't find 3-2 blackjack unless you're willing to bet $25 or $50 minimum.
Well, but isn't your game the equivalent of that if you're doubling for four times? Even if you're starting at five, you're ending up betting 25.
So my game, the average, so if, on a $5 table, for example, it's essentially a $20 minimum game, except what happens is it has a payoff frequency of 67%, which means you get something back on 67% of hands, because what happens is you split 57% of hands. So there would be a lot of hands where you win one hand and lose the other, and so it's a push. Which is a payoff. So it's actually technically it's a lower variance $20 minimum game, or a high variance $5 minimum game.
So in your game, blackjack pays 2-1, right?
Yes.
So is the game, what all our listeners want to know is the game countable?
No. It would be, except it's not going to be countable because it'd have to be dealt from a continuous shuffler, and the problem is,
why would it have to be?
Because it would be absurdly countable.
Okay, so now we're like this game.
Yes. Yeah, that's, you know, these are the things you have to think about as a game designer, is what the casino would want and what the player would want. This is a compromise between not allowing a countable game and having a low-edge game. That, you know, if you came to gamble, this is the game for you. If you didn't come to gamble and you want to bet the minimum, and you actually can't play $5 backer on the strip anyway.
Well, the other thing that might be good about this is it's the potential for the casino to misrate you, you know, or are you telling them how they should rate the players who play it?
I have nothing to do with that.
Okay, so there's potential there. I mean, if they rate you as a $25 player thinking that their edge is 2% on $25, then that could be potentially good as well.
Right. I mean, I guess thinking from an advantage player's perspective, yes.
Yeah, well, yeah. That is the name of the show, right? Gambling with an Edge.
Right. We're talking to Jeff Wong. We're going to do some commercials now, And we're going to come back and talk about an article that we referred to last week called The Death of Blackjack and What Games Are Replacing It. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. On Sunday, Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, there's a $500,000 swipe, spin, and win promotion. That is, play 3,000 points, go to a kiosk, and spin a virtual wheel. Prizes at the top end are $50 or $25 free play. At the bottom end is 2,500 points worth $750, a free breakfast buffet, or a $10 restaurant credit. It's a random draw, so even though I've been playing there for a long time and get a good mailer, my chances at a good prize are no greater than somebody who just signed up today. Over the first couple weeks, my average spin has been slightly in excess of $20 for the $300 worth of points on playing on an even game. So it is a good low roller play. At the Palms, on the weekly 7 p.m. drawings Friday night, winners share $10,000. Top prize is $3,000. You don't need to be there to win. You need to claim the prize by midnight or it goes away. They have multiple drawing entries on Fridays. PFP, play for prizes through April 10th. I'll skip that part. From now until April 24th, which is the end of this week, is going to be Lowe's gift cards. Up to $185 of Lowe's and $5 at Coffee Bean may be redeemed Monday through Friday at a rate of 0.20% for video poker players. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. The gold membership, it'll get you correction on numerous games. They have game of the week every week, and cash prizes are given to the winners. The winner this week, or the prize, the game this week is Multi-Strike. Multi-Strike is a four-line game where you pay for all four lines up front. You play the bottom line. If you win, which means at least get your money back, then you get to play the next line at double the stakes, but you don't have to pay anymore. If you win there too, then you play the next line up at four times, and the top line is at eight times. There are four different strategies to learn, because in regular video poker, when you're finished with a hand, it's over, but here, if you score on a hand, you get to play for free at this point a game with higher stakes for double the stakes. So the more of those free things that are in the future, the more you tend to take a sure thing rather than a speculative hand. The Video Poker for Winners software allows you to get the perfect strategy for any pay schedule. All right, let's talk about the game, the article that Jeff Huang wrote a few months ago for The Motley Fool. It's called The Death of Blackjack and What Games Are Replacing It. This last week we mentioned it. This week we have some time. So 30 years ago, blackjack games made up about 80% of the table games in the American casino. Today, it's down to just a little above 50%. Jeff Huang, what happened? What caused this decrease?
All right, so a lot of this has happened in the last 10, 15 years. So in 2000, there were 3,700 blackjack tables in the state of Nevada. By 2013, that number was down to 2,700 tables. One of the things that's changed is the emergence of the continuous shuffling machine. That was the first big change. And actually, you have to go back, 50 years to Ed Thorpe and beat the dealer. One of the things that really drove blackjack's popularity was the idea that the game was beatable and countable. So when you take away the continuous shuffling, or when you add the continuous shuffling machine, you take away card counting. So you kind of reduce the incentive for the player to learn basic strategy, or even basic strategy. The other thing that's happened in the last 5 to 10 years is that 6 to 5 blackjack games have started to populate, you know, casinos all over America, but especially on the Strip, and not just single deck 6 to 5. It's now 2-deck and multi-deck 6 to 5 on the Strip. So you can't play, traditional 3 to 2 blackjack on the Strip unless you're willing to play $25 to $50 minimum hand, depending on where you go on the Strip. And so blackjack at 1.9% or whatever, so at 1.9%. Even playing perfect basic strategy, you can do a lot better at craps. Yeah, pass line craps, 1.4%. And so if you're a new gambler or a millennial, or you haven't learned gambling yet, there's less and less incentive to learn even basic strategy for blackjack. It's just not even worth it. And so I think this will contribute a lot to the decline of the game. And why this is why there are fewer tables, and why there will likely be fewer tables in the future, as fewer people pick up basic strategy for blackjack. And it's one of the things that's interesting about this is that they've had rule changes before, going back to beat the dealer. The casino is always taking away rules and then giving some back because players have refused to play those games. What's changed in the last 10-15 years is that blackjack is less important. 1985, blackjack was 56% of table games revenue, and table games were important. Today, much of the Strip table games revenue is driven by high stakes baccarat. It also, there are a lot more casinos in America. A lot of these are locals and regional properties, and at these properties, slot machines are now 70-80%, and sometimes 90%, depending on the jurisdiction, of revenue. So table games are less important, and blackjack's less important, and so casino operators, pretty much refusing to offer the 3-2 blackjack. Because they can, it's just not that important anymore, and they don't have to worry about surveillance or trying to catch card counters or any of it.
It seems that the players have moved to wanting that bigger payoff. Like these side bets have become so popular because they don't want to win even money. They want that chance of hitting 10-1 or 40-1 or whatever on these side bets. So,
well, see, that's not even true. Some gamblers want that, and these are idiots because all the side bets
special class of gamblers called idiots.
What's really happening is that people are the smarter class of gamblers that used to play blackjack at 0.5%, they stopped gambling at all. So this is the whole talk of the industry is how do we get millennials to gamble? Why don't they play our slot machines at 15%? Well, there's their answers because millennials, we all have access to the internet. Hang on, I'm 34. I'm in this age bracket. We all grew up. We're all a lot more knowledgeable about gambling than everybody that came before us. We have all these books that are written. We have internet. All this information is free. We can see what the house advantage is on craps. We can see what the house advantage is on blackjack. And this is part of this is why I started this company, this game design company, is to deliver lower edge games for an intelligent class of gambler. And one of the things that's never happened before is that nobody's ever created a game and marketed it to a gambler. Because you can't present the house advantage numbers for a game like three-card poker, 3.3%, 2% per unit wagered. You can't give them that number because if you've given them that number, they know it's bad.
Yet that game is hugely popular.
Not for intelligent players.
Well,
just the idiots.
Unless you're hole carding.
Yeah.
It's totally, totally different class of player. So my goal is to deliver games that you can deliver, you can say, here's the number, this is the game, and an intelligent player will say, oh, yeah, I'll take that. I just want to hang out in the casino and gamble a little bit, and I will play these games.
Yeah, but I think there are far fewer than the people who will play three-card poker.
That's the theory. So people are wondering why people don't gamble anymore. My goal is to bring these people back to the casino, just hang out, gamble a little bit, and give a game that intelligent players, not necessarily advantage players, will play.
Does your game have a side bet or no?
Not this one. This side bet is actually built into the main game.
Well, you have the forced ante, which is kind of a side bet.
Yeah.
I have other games with side bets, and that's the other part of my theory is to have lower edge side bets that intelligent people bet on more outcomes, without having to stoop down to the level of idiot.
I mean, what is it just seems like there are so many games already. and they're constantly adding more. Is it just the casino thinking, let's just throw everything at the wall and see what sticks? Or why is there this insatiable demand for new games?
Well, there is and there isn't. So what we find is, and there are actually very few companies now, because now Caesars and MGM control most of the Strip, and they actually offer most of the same games on all the properties. So there are actually very few games that really make it. There are a lot of games being developed because it's really cheap to come up with a game idea, not necessarily cheap to develop it, which is why I see a lot of games. But these aren't good ideas, and this is actually why I've written all these articles on my site on game design, and establishing all these concepts. It's because all my games are designed with certain key elements, certain concepts in mind that aren't being reached or haven't been developed yet. So, and a lot of the games being designed are kind of random, or these are games that, you know, maybe you've been as a kid. They're pretty similar. But if people want to gamble, they don't want, you know, they bet their money on this. They want to bet on, you know, something substantial or something that doesn't look like something that a kid made up.
Well, the other thing is, you know, talking about millennials, if you grew up playing Xbox and PlayStation, to look at a slot machine is almost insulting, right? It's like it has reels that go around, like that's it. So I think there's a real, to me, that would be the holy grail, would be some kind of interactive game that has some skill element to it.
That's the other thing I'm doing, so I have a whole series of poker games. There's limited space on the casino floor, but if you can put all these skill-based poker games into a single box, you know, that might appeal to somebody looking to play, you know, something with a skill element at a low edge.
Uh-huh.
One of the premises of your article was that if a game requires skill to learn, it basically should be more advantageous to the player, and if it has zero skill, like Keno or something, or craps, it should have a high house edge. And that generally holds true with a lot of exceptions. In video poker, it doesn't hold true at all. It's like the toughest game is Joker Wild, or at least one of the toughest. And it comes in 100% versions, and it comes in 92% versions. And the 92% version is no easier to play well than the 101% version. And so Deuces Wild is fairly simple to play, and some of the highest, for low stakes, the highest returning common quarter game in Vegas is a Deuces Wild game, and that's relatively easy. So your premise may be true for table games, but in video poker it's not true at all.
Well, no, it's, what I'm talking about is simple economics. So craps at 1.4%, 1.41% on the pass line requires zero skill. Baccarat, the baker bet baccarat, is 1.06%. So it requires zero skill. So economically, if we're gonna have a game that requires skill, it should have a lower house advantage, at least per unit wagered, than a game that requires skill. It's simple economics. If you're gonna require a player to learn skill, then you have to charge a lower rate if he has skill.
And what he's saying generally holds true in that slot machines have zero skill and the house advantage is way higher than video poker, where
considerable, you know, skill.
And what you're talking about is price discrimination. So for example, price, the casino wants, and the casino does it all the time. So a 25 cent slot machine has a higher, a lower house advantage than a penny slot, you know, the casino doesn't want to offer baccarat at $5 on the strip because that's too low a house advantage. You have to pay $25, $50 minimum. Same thing with 3-2 blackjack.
Actually, I heard that that a $5 blackjack table on the strip would be a money losing game for the casino. Cost of putting a dealer behind that table with a $5 minimum, it would be negative to the casino.
Which is why they have to charge a higher house advantage.
Right, right.
And, right.
Or why you move those tables to the video blackjack.
And why is why blackjack is kind of dying.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So we have just a few seconds left. We did make our debut on Vegas AllNet Radio. And even though it's early in the morning and Jeff is a poker player, he's wide awake. Don't expect that true of all poker players. So thank you, Richard. Thank you, Jeff. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good afternoon.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Mutchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.